This is an ABC podcast.
This is the South Australian Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hello, Isabella Pittaway with you for the Country Hour today and for the next few months. Thanks so much for your company. Coming up on the show today, how will the world feed 10 billion people by 2050?
We've got to produce an extra 60 to 80% more food. You know, it's really important that we're adopting all the tools in the shed, if you like, when it comes to technologies. And I would have to say, you know, that includes technology like GMO technology.
We'll hear about the work being done in crop speed breeding to help keep the planet fed. Also today, trying to keep your sheep alive during a drought can come at a big sacrifice. One farmer from far west New South Wales has been droving a mob of sheep for the past 18 months and still won't be home for a while. That story is coming up after the weather. But first, though, the value of all that is grown on Australian farms is expected to fall next year. The latest from Government commodity forecaster ABARES suggests we're on track to hit $59 billion worth of produce. Kath Sullivan has more.
If, and it's a pretty big if, seasonal conditions return to normal in the coming months, the value of Australia's farm produce is expected to fall by 3%. ABARES chief analyst Peter Gooday explains.
So that's driven by a fall in the value of livestock exports. So we're expecting livestock exports to fall by about 11% in value. We turned off a lot of animals this year, so we're starting from a reasonably high level. And as seasonal conditions improve, we're expecting that producers will be looking to rebuild herds and flocks.
So you see farmers keeping their animals to breed rather than slaughtering them for export markets?
That's right. So as seasonal conditions allow, so that's one of the main points here, is that come spring we're assuming average seasonal conditions. So if that doesn't happen, then we'd be looking at further increases in turnoff and a further reduction in the herd. So the cattle herd will finish this year at about 25 million head, which is the lowest sort of level since the early 1990s.
And the flock?
Well, the sheep flocks around about 67 million head, and we're expecting that to increase next year to about 69 million.
Okay, it seems Australian wheat growers are pretty optimistic. I understand more area has been sown, yet at the same time we're importing grain for the first time in some years. So what's the story there?
The winter crop prospects at this point in the season look better this year than they looked last year. So we're expecting that the winter crop production will be up by about 20% compared to last year. That's still 10% below the longer term average. So we haven't really seen conditions in northern New South Wales and southern Queensland improve substantially. But the other states, we're expecting Western Australia and Victoria to have reasonably average crops this year. South Australia are a bit better than average. But for New South Wales and Queensland, well below average. You know, New South Wales 30% below average and Queensland a bit more than 40% down.
Across the commodities, the latest forecast is mixed, but National Farmers Federation President Fiona Simpson remains optimistic and is committed to growing the value of Australian farm production to $100 billion by the year 2030.
At the moment, we have a really strong amount of confidence, rural confidence in Australia, but farmer sentiment is really low. And I think it's probably low because of the weather and because of the drought conditions that are really now widespread over large parts of Australia.
Is there really any part of Australia that's been unaffected by the difficult seasons?
Certainly there are pockets. We see Western Australia, which was struggling, has now come up again with some recent rain. So there's areas of Western Australia that I think would be feeling quite buoyant at the moment, and also some pockets throughout the inland land, where we saw those floodwaters go and some of that recent rain up in Queensland trending down. So there are certainly pockets across Australia that are good, but then that is offset by the large amounts of area that is very bad, and really looking at a really tough winter without some rain.
When you talk about where we're at the moment, what do you expect in terms of recovery and how long it's going to take to get the country's farmers back on their feet?
Yeah, look, it's going to take some time. I think what has helped farmers in some ways is that some of the commodity prices have stayed strong. At the moment, we have, for example, record lamb prices in Australia. We've also seen quite high grain prices because we've mostly been basing those on the domestic market. Cotton has been very high as well. In fact, record highs, I think, in cotton this last season. So they have sort of kept, you know, as some sort of momentum. But, you know, really now when we're heading into winter, in fact, we're really almost in the middle of winter in some areas, and we're looking at really such a tough season, and people are destocking, people are selling off their stock, and people have perhaps winter crops in the ground, but the future of those crops remains uncertain without further rainfall, then it could take really, you know, not just months but years for many farmers to recover.
That was National Farmers Federation President Fiona Simpson ending that report from Kath Sullivan. And if you have any thoughts on this forecast drop by ABARES or any of today's stories, you can send us a text on 0467 922 783 or you can give us a call on 1300 222 891. We would love to hear from you. Well, a Queensland scientist says researchers globally are doubling their efforts to find drought-tolerant wheat varieties to address falling yields. University of Queensland research fellow Dr. Kay Fosfels says wheat is one of the world's most important crops, providing on average 20% of people's daily calorie intake. He says he's been particularly interested in improving the plant's root structure.
Last year was actually a record-breaking year in terms of drought in Europe, I'd say in the whole of Europe. I know the situation a lot better in northwestern Europe, Germany. My brother is managing a farm there, and we've had record-breaking droughts, ranging maybe in the magnitude of 30 to 70% losses, crop losses on average.
Wow.
But also leading to complete crop failure. So farmers are now really, I mean, they're speaking up and they're saying we do need better adapted varieties.
So tell me about your research into the root system of different wheat varieties.
It's pretty obvious that roots are very, very important. They're the primary interface for water or nutrient acquisition of the plant. And we're doing a lot of research here at UQ to improve root systems in future or in modern wheat or barley varieties.
What do you mean by improve?
This is a very, very good question because there is not such thing like the ideal root genotype or the ideal root system. It's more like tailoring root systems to specific environmental conditions. So in environments where you have very, very shallow soils, sandy soils, and comparatively, you know, reasonably much rainfall throughout the growing season, then you might want more shallow root systems that don't penetrate the soil so deep, that don't, or genotypes that don't invest so much into producing root systems, because the plant can only produce carbohydrates so much, and it's always about resource allocation and how much energy do I put into, you know, growing roots, or how much energy is left to put into the grain filling process.
Deeper wheat varieties are being investigated. How are they going?
Oh, well, so this is actually a really, really good question, because so far we've been investigating in much detail the genetic factors that are actually controlling those features. Does a genotype grow more narrow roots or more shallow roots, or does a genotype produce more biomass at depth? What we're currently doing in a really large international effort, including researchers from all across Europe, but also Mexico, what we're currently trying to do is produce a whole bunch of what we call root idiotypes. So what we're doing is basically we're taking important Australian varieties and we're making basically copy versions of them, but just with modified root systems. And then we're going to test those. Well, this is going to be in the next 1 or 2 years. We're going to test those under specific environmental conditions to really work out what's the best root system idiotype for the specific farmer's needs.
But why are you concentrating on the root structure? Why not yield for your research, for example?
Well, obviously the roots, they are taking on really important functions. First of all, they are anchoring the plants. This is really critical. If you think about increasing the yield potential, for example, in wheat, you know, you might think of increasing the length of the spike or increasing the genetic capacity to produce more kernels per spike. This is not going to work out if the physical aspects of the plants are not in a certain way. So plants might break and so on. So you have to have really strong roots that anchor the plants. This is the first thing. The next thing is roots are, like I said, the primary interface for resource acquisition. So this is basically how the plant interacts with the soil in which it's growing, in. So they're extremely important for nutrient uptake, but also for water uptake, obviously.
And just out of interest, how deep have you seen some wheat varieties go in terms of their root system to find water?
This is a very good question. So I think, depending on the genotype, they can easily reach, I'd say maybe 1.5 meters, 2 meters.
Wow.
But then it's getting really tricky for us, you know, to dig these things up. But we're certainly running into problems when we want to test those things out under artificial conditions in the glasshouse, because we need massive containers to test them.
And just finally, Dr. Kai Vosfels, I'm just interested, back to your homeland in Germany, what would you reckon would be a bad wheat crop yield, just out of interest?
Yeah, Europe is one of the major global wheat producers, producing probably around 4 to 5 times as much wheat grain as Australia. So we're looking at a production region where yields are amongst the highest in the world.
Yep.
So just to give you a feel, so my brother, he's a farmer in Western Germany, and if he harvests less than 8 tons per hectare, he's probably pretty pissed, to say it frankly.
Now you're rubbing it in, Dr. Kai.
but I do have to say we're spoiled in terms of, you know, rainfall. We have really good soils, so we have it a lot easier compared to some producers here in Australia.
That's Dr. Kai Vosfels, Research Fellow with the University of Queensland, speaking there with Amy Phillips. And let's stay with crops, because an Australian researcher says plant breeders will need to combine multiple technologies to meet the challenge of feeding 10 billion people by 2050. A review led by Dr. Lee Hickey from the University of Queensland and published in the journal Nature Biotechnology says technology like speed breeding and temperature manipulation will be needed to create new resilient varieties of major crops like wheat and corn. He told Kelly Buchanan, scientists from around the world are teaming up to fast-track plant breeding.
One of the technologies that I'm quite well known for is this speed breeding technology, but it's still just one tool in the shed for a plant breeder. What we propose is really that we need to bring all these technologies together, and then a real step change is possible in terms of making these crops more resilient in the face of climate change and more productive on farms.
What kind of technologies do you think would work well in conjunction with something like the speed breeding that you've developed?
Well, the good thing is that speed breeding is, you know, highly compatible with these other technologies, whether it's sequencing and tracking genes that plant breeders are interested in for drought or disease resistance, or other technologies like genome editing, for instance. We particularly propose some ideas around how do we remove some of the bottlenecks associated with this genome editing technology. It normally, the plants have to go through the lab, and there's a lot of restrictions in terms of, you know, it only works on particular types of plants, and this really slows down the breeding progress. So what we propose is some ideas around how we could take genome editing out of the lab and transform it from a biotechnology that's really promising into a plant breeding technology that we can do at a massive scale. And because plant breeders want to deal with thousands or hundreds of thousands of plants. So we need to find a way to really scale up these technologies and reduce the cost, which is really important for a plant breeding program. So what we're trying to do is create a plant factory, if you like, and it's growing the greatest number of plants in the smallest space possible. So for some of these crops, we're growing them at a rate of 1,000 plants per square meter and actually setting up these bee breeding facilities indoors. So we're actually creating warehouses where we're growing these plants. We don't have to grow them in a traditional glass house. It's a lot cheaper now to grow them indoors because you don't have to contend with the sunlight. It's cheaper to cool the growing environment. And you know, there's just a lot of innovation in the lighting technology, the LED lights that now make all this possible.
You're in Russia at the moment meeting other plant breeders to talk about, among other things, the challenge of feeding 10 billion people by 2050. How significant is the work that's being done in breeding to making sure that we keep this planet fed?
That's right. I'm here with a whole bunch of leading plant scientists who are really coming together to talk about breeding our crops because we face this huge challenge of feeding the world. And I think the stats are something like we've got to produce an extra 60 to 80% more food. You know, it's really important that we're adopting all the tools in the shed, if you like, when it comes to technologies. And I would have to say, you know, that includes technology like GMO technology.
Dr. Hickey, your work is getting attention worldwide. Have you been able to collaborate with other scientists from around the world on this challenge?
One particular exciting collaboration is our work with ICRISAT, based in India. But they breed crops for many farmers in developing countries throughout Africa and Asia. And so what we're doing is we're working together to set up these bee breeding facilities that will help, you know, fast-track their breeding programs. And it's pretty exciting because, you know, as of next year, we'll be building facilities in places like India and Mali, Zimbabwe. And this will help fast-track breeding for crops that haven't had much investment, like sorghum and millets, peanuts, for instance. And these crops are so critical to, you know, nutrition and global food security in those regions.
How significant will that be for those regions to be able to get these more resilient varieties in the ground faster?
I think it's going to be very significant because if we think about major crops that we grow in developed countries like Australia or the US, we think of maize, wheat, and we've made a lot of progress in those crops to improve the quality, the yield on farms. But these other crops haven't received much investment and have really fallen behind. And I have to say, you know, there's a lot of low-hanging fruit to be made in terms of genetic progress. And I think it's exciting what we can do if we adopt these new technologies. We can breed those disease-resistant, drought-tolerant, more productive crops. And to give those benefits to poorer farmers in those developing countries, it's something that I'm really excited to be involved in. And I think it'll have a lasting impact into the future.
That's Senior Research Fellow Dr. Lee Hickey speaking there to Callie Buchanan. And a text in on this topic, no name, but an observation on technology that's being used to produce food to feed the planet. It says, keeping up farm production to feed a growing population. It's frustrating that the ag industry is so focused on this when we as farmers have been producing and supplying ahead of demands for 50 plus years. And surprise, surprise, our terms of trade have been in a constant decline for this whole time. Even though we have some relatively high prices at the moment for grain and meat, they haven't even gone close to keeping up with indexation over this time. Let's focus on profit and sustainability rather than just producing more and more. Thanks for your text. We do love to know who they're coming from, but if you'd like to get in touch on this topic or any of the other stories we're talking about today, you can send us a text on 0467 922 783. Or if you want to give us a call, you can call 1300 222 891.
Check out Narelle Graham.
You are worried about the ease of sports betting. Why?
With online gambling, it's very, very easy for particularly young people to set up a sports betting account. And their gambling is not only completely unsupervised, but it's almost completely unregulated.
And you're saying, Stephen Mulligan, that we can't track it.
Weekdays from four.
So you can actually buy yourself from online services.
Yes, definitely. Yeah.
Right. Is that more difficult?
Don't miss Narelle Graham.
On ABC Radio, South Australia and Broken Hill.
You're listening to the South Australian Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Where it is 24 past 12. My name's Isabella Pittaway. Lovely to have your company this Tuesday. Let's change pace now because a school equine program that started as a trial in 2014 has evolved into a regular fixture at a rural school. The Lucendale Area School's equine program runs in terms 2 and 4. Lucendale community members donate their horses and their time to transport the horses to the school for the program. And it's given students who wouldn't have otherwise had the chance to learn more about the animals. One of those is Year 5 student Maddie Han.
Well, we had a little Shetland pony that we got from a friend, and sometimes we used to ride her, but then she got a bit older so we couldn't ride her as much. And then when we started the equine program, we got to do a bit more experience with horses.
What kind of experience did you get?
Well, doing lots of different things that I didn't know how to do before, like jumping, trotting, and things like that.
What things do you like the most about it?
I do like jumping, but sometimes I get worried that I'm not going to get it.
How rewarding is it when you do get it? It must be hard leading up to doing that.
It feels good because you feel like you've achieved something, and when you achieve something, it's good.
Maddie Han is just one of the students who's involved in the Lucendale Area School's equine program. It started in 2014 as a trial. It ran after school some days for students who wanted to get involved. Now it's a twice-yearly six-week program and a regular staple at Lucendale Area School. Lucinda Smith started the program in 2014 and says it's been wonderful to watch it grow.
Over the last, 2 years, we have, with consultation with the staff and principal at the school, we've actually evolved it into a lunchtime, then after lunch, and now after school activity. So it actually runs throughout the school day, which has been fantastic. Bit of a change, and also allows us to fit more students in and get a better ratio for that group and instructor time.
How was it able to evolve that much?
I think it just stems back to that community that is passionate about the equine industry or passionate about different aspects of horses. And it's basically through community support and teacher support and student support that it has continued. We are very fortunate at Lucendale that we have a range of different people within the town that share a love of horses. We have a local camp draft facility which allow us to use their facilities, and different people that are in different disciplines of the equine industry that come in and help support or teach kids their skills. So yeah, it's a fantastic way to link our school and community together.
The program runs for 6 weeks twice a year and teaches students how to ride and care for horses. But it's not just for students who don't have access to horses otherwise. Experienced riders like Year 11 student Christy Bauer are also involved to help teach other students.
So I only moved to Lucendale at the end of last year, and I have a big love of horses, and I thought it'd be really good to get out there and ride with younger people. And it's helped me a lot with being able to, since I'm an advanced rider, I'd say, maybe, I've been able to help and teach other people, which I found really good because the teachers have let me do that.
What do you like most about teaching other people?
It gives me experience, and just being able to teach someone something and then they're being able to learn and being able to do it, I find that very good. And I want to be in the horse training industry when I'm out of school, so it gives me heaps and heaps of experience of how I need to teach people. And then also makes me think about how I do stuff and if it's the right way, and I'll be able to improve my knowledge at the same time.
Teachers say the students involved with the equine program are doing well outside of it too. Health and PE teacher Celeste Peach says when kids master something in the equine program, that confidence carries over into other classes too.
There's particular students that you see amazing growth over just the 6-week time that we do it in term 2 and term 4. So there's kids that start out and they have no idea about horses. They've never ridden before. And then by the end, you see them, confidently riding, walking around by themselves. And I guess just building a relationship with an animal, but also building the confidence to achieve things that they may not have thought was possible is a huge thing.
That's Lucindale Area School teacher Celeste Peach speaking there to Leonie Thorne. We are heading up to 12:30, so let's find out what's making news across the state. It's good afternoon to Anita Butcher.
Good afternoon, Isabella. In news headlines, the Northern Adelaide Waste Management Authority will receive millions from the state government to combat Australia's mounting waste problem. The $12 million funding package, to be spread over 4 years, will be put towards more jobs, education programs and infrastructure projects. Authority Chief Executive Adam Faulkner says the money will substantially benefit recyclable waste management. Counting of votes for South Australian Senate candidates in the federal election has been completed today. The Liberal Party won 3 Senate positions in SA, with Anne Rustin and David Fawcett returned, and lawyer Alex Antic its latest appointment. Marielle Smith is Labor's new SA Senator, while Alex Gallagher was returned, and Green Senator Sarah Hanson-Young also won another term. And researchers from Flinders University have found turbines at the Waterloo Wind Farm create low-frequency thumping and rumbling noises extending 3.5 kilometres. The noise, which can be heard for more than 15% of the time, is caused by the mechanical workings of the turbine, such as its turning blades and power output. Researcher Dr. Christy Hansen says findings correlate with noise complaints logged by nearby residents, but possible health effects aren't yet known. More news at 1.
Thanks, Anita. That's Anita Butcher there with the news headlines. It was a chilly start this morning. Let's see what's in store for the rest of today across the state. It's good afternoon to senior forecaster Mark Analak.
Good afternoon, and I can tell you there's some chilly weather still on the way. So, we'll brace ourselves for that. But when I spoke to someone yesterday, we have had a few changes in the forecast coming up. So as we speak, there's a high pressure system moving into the sort of southern Bight area, and as a result, cool southerly winds are bringing some very light shower activity to southern coastal parts of our state. Tomorrow, that high pressure system will be forced to move northwards over inland parts of the pastoral districts, and that's because an upper level disturbance will create a low pressure system to form south of Port Lincoln during tomorrow. And as that low pressure system develops, we will see some cloud increasing and shower activity pushing up over southern and western coasts during the day tomorrow. And into Thursday, that low pressure system is expected to continue to develop but gradually move northeastwards towards Investigator Strait and Gulf St. Vincent during the day on Thursday. With the movement of that low pressure system, we are expecting an increase in shower activity, particularly along central and western coasts of South Australia, but the showers themselves will push you over agricultural areas, possibly even to the far southern parts of the pastoral districts during Thursday. On Friday, that low pressure system is expected to decay, and with that, showers will gradually ease and contract southwards through Friday and into the weekend. Under the influence of that high pressure system, the northern parts of our state will have some clear nights and some very cold nights ahead. Areas of frost are forecast, particularly for the pastoral districts, but also northern agricultural areas at times and over the coming days. And at this stage, our coldest mornings look like they'll be Thursday morning and again on Saturday morning, with some locally severe frosts likely over the coming days in susceptible areas. By the time we get to the end of the weekend and the early part of next week, generally fine conditions are forecast, but later, towards the middle part of next week, there might be another weakening trough moving across from the west, so some light shower activity possible developing in the west on late Monday, and then sliding down across southern coastal fringes during Tuesday. In terms of rainfall amounts, with the development of this low pressure system, we are expecting a slight change there. So rainfall totals generally looking at 2 to 10 millimetres between now and Saturday night over the agricultural area, increasing to 10 to 30 millimetres about Kangaroo Island and the southern parts of Eyre Peninsula, York Peninsula and also the Fleurieu Peninsula. Further north, areas north of about Fowler's Bay to Hawker to Renmark can expect less than 2 millimetres. But also the low pressure system doesn't really bring any shower activity to the southeast district. So less than 2 millimetres are forecast for the upper and lower southeast district right through to the end of Saturday. So in short, yes, there's some showery and some showers expected over the central and western parts of the state particularly. Cold in the north, but I guess gradually easing up for the latter part of the weekend.
Well, I guess we can't complain too much. It is winter, Mark. I think that what's the buffer for complaining it's cold? Is it like the first couple of weeks of winter and then you just have to stop? Or
You just have to suck it up really, don't you?
Yeah, so, you do.
Oh, well, that's the way it goes. It is winter and some people feel the cold more than others, but certainly this week ahead will feel very cold. Some very cold nights, and the days themselves won't warm up that much either. So temperatures hovering in the low to mid-teens for most of the listening viewers.
Worth getting a couple extra blankets out this week. Thanks for your time, Mark.
Thank you. See ya.
That's Senior Forecaster Mark Analak at the Weather Bureau. In the far west of New South Wales, it'll be a sunny day. Overnight temperatures falling to around 4 degrees, with daytime temperatures reaching around 15. And for lower western, a mostly sunny day with patchy morning frost in the far west. And overnight temperatures falling to around 2, with daytime temperatures reaching around 14.
While you're working on the land, listening to your favourite mixtapes, you could just be this year's Australian Farmer of the Year. Entries are now easier than ever before, and we want to uncover and celebrate innovation and diversity on Australian farms. Enter yourself or someone you know at farmeroftheyear.com.au. Proudly supported by Kundinna Group and ABC Rural.
Yes, you can nominate now for the 10th Annual Australian Farmer of the Year Awards, and we've made it easier than ever before to enter yourself, so no complaining. You can enter yourself or someone you know. You just need to go to farmeroftheyear.com.au for all the details. And I have to say, I feel like there's been a fair few Victorian winners over the past couple of years, so I am creating some interstate rivalry here, but it'd be great to see someone from South Australia take out the awards. Winners get to take part in a leadership program funded by the Department of Agriculture and Water Resources, and you can be nominated in the following categories. There's Young Farmer, Rural Community Leader, Rural Consultant, and Farming Legend and Agricultural Student of the Year, as well as the Overall Australian Farmer of the Year category. And the awards are hosted by Kundinna Group and, of course, ABC Rural, and nominations close on June 30th. You are listening to the South Australian Country Hour. My name's Isabella Pittaway, and it is about 23 minutes to 1. And geez, record lamb prices continue to fall as supply tightens. Last week, the South Australian lamb price record was broken by Mundulla lambs at $337. Well, now the national record has once again fallen. Gary Micken and the Micken family sold White Suffolk for $350 a head at Corowa yesterday. And as you'd expect, they're pretty happy with the result.
Lambs were very good last year. We hoped that it would happen again, and it has. And, you know, it's probably cost us 65 kilos to, $65 to feed these lambs, but they started about 60 kilos when we started them, so it wasn't too bad. They're enormous lambs, as good as we've ever produced, and, you know, I think we can do it again or even produce better. You must keep trying to reach the ultimate, because once you think you've got the best article, then you're going backwards.
Gary Micken there, his White Suffolk reaching $350 a head at Corowa yesterday. Well, from highs to lows, the drought has forced families to separate to keep stock alive, while others have sold up and moved out of the far west of New South Wales. Mick Anderson is from Simbrick Vale Station, about 185 kilometres northeast of Broken Hill. He's currently driving a mob of 2,500 sheep looking for feed and told Andrew Schmidt he won't return home until September.
This was the sort of last option available as far as getting him on some decent feed. So we just put an application in for a travelling stock permit with the two shires up here, and that got approved. And yeah, we came up and had a look, and then we've sort of been up here 3.5 weeks now.
So, all right, so your property is about, what, 185 k's northeast of Broken Hill?
Yep.
Have you walked the sheep all the way, or have you trucked them to Queensland? And then,
yeah, no, we trucked. So we had three road trains come up to Charleville, and then just ran them off the back of the truck there, just over the Warrego, and then give us a couple of days there on a bit of a reserve just to settle in. And then from then on, we've just been doing our 10Ks a day.
So you've got to actually get permission off the shires up there to I suppose I'll use the term, go droving?
That's exactly it, yeah. So that goes in, and then each shire's got a ranger which is responsible for the management of the stock route. And then they review your application and give you the yay or the nay. And then basically once we got approval from both councils, we came up here and met the rangers and just had a look at the route and how we're going to go about it, and see away we went.
So, Mickey, you're following them on motorbikes, or you're in the ute. What are you doing?
I'm just packing up the brake at the moment, which is the yard you build every night to put the sheep in. So I'll pack that up now, and then I'll shift the camp up 10Ks to where we're going to camp tonight, and then, get it all set up for when the mob gets there this afternoon.
In your own mind, Mick, how long do you think you'll be on the road? Is it till the drought breaks, or are you giving it 6 months? What are you doing?
Look, it's these sheep that once we got that 20 mils there at Easter time, like I did have rams in with these sheep, and they start to cycle a bit. So, you know, once we get into sort of mid-September, you know, I'd imagine that a few will be pretty heavy in lamb, but we'll probably scan them in a month and just see what's going on with them. So, but, you know, I've been living away from home for 18 months now, sort of down south last year and now up here. So I'd like to think by September I could get home.
And you've got a property just out of Victor Harbour, not a big property, but you've got some, what, core breeding stock there, have you?
No, we had two-thirds of our sheep down there last year, pretty much hand-fed them all year. Got little bits and pieces of adjustment at different times on little blocks down that way. And then, yeah, basically shifted most of them back prior to Christmas. And then the last couple of loads we brought back just prior to bringing those sheep up here.
So your wife, Britt, two young daughters are still on the property?
Yep, that's it. Yep, so Britt's got still bit over 1,100 ewes down there that she's keeping an eye on between you're teaching the kids school and everything else that's got to be done.
Do you see what you're doing at the moment, is this about the last resort, or was the last resort obviously selling your stock, but you don't want to do that? So is this the last resort to try and keep them alive?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, this country, I would imagine from what we're seeing now, if they get to, you know, late September up here, they're going to need to have had a bit of substantial rain, or it's going to need to rain pretty well, otherwise, you know, they'll be back into some pretty lean times themselves. So, and as far as that, you know, this is pretty much where you keep thinking it's the last roll of the dice, but yeah, you know, if we don't get these stock through, things will look pretty grim, that's for sure.
Mick Anderson is from Simbrick Vale Station speaking there to Andrew Schmidt, and it's a long time on the road, isn't it? 18 months, and he's still got a few more to go until he's back home. Well, we heard earlier how much lambs are worth, so when newborns don't survive, the loss in potential income can add up. So how can you give your lambs the best chance of survival? There are lots of strategies farmers are adopting to lift lamb survival rates. Consultant Nathan Scott says they range from weighing newborns to installing temporary electric fencing.
Yeah, so birth weight's obviously a very critical thing in terms of lamb survival, and the more we can do to make sure that we get birth weights in the ideal range, the better our results will be. So our ideal range is between 4.5 and 5.5 kilograms. We get a lot of our clients and everyone that we talk to ideally to weigh any lambs that they come across just so that they understand whether they are hitting that correct spec, because it certainly dramatically increases the chance of survival.
If they're bigger than that?
If they're bigger than that, then that can create problems as well, so birthing difficulties. So that's why it is an ideal range. We want to hit a minimum level so that we give them a really good chance of survival from an exposure point of view, but we don't want to push it too far where we end up with difficult births.
In practical terms, how do you go out and weigh lambs in the middle of a paddock?
With our clients, it's actually really simple. We just use luggage scales. So just cheap digital luggage scales, and it's a very quick and easy process just to weigh the lamb and see what its weight is. Often you can just sit them in a bucket and weigh the bucket with the lamb in it, and it's really simple. And it tells the farmer a lot about the things that they've got right and things that they can do better in the future.
Exposure seems to be a really limiting factor in lamb mortalities. How do you reduce those mortalities from exposure?
So there's both a long-term game and a short-term game in terms of exposure. So if we can get more shelter across farms, that's obviously a big factor. But that's a long-term game because most of it's done with tree plantations and trees take time. And our aim with tree plantations is to cut the wind speed across the paddock. So they are significant plantations, not just little patches of trees, if that makes sense. From a short-term point of view, some of the best shelter we can actually provide is the ewe herself. So if the ewe's really comfortable and we've looked after her really well, she sits down and the lamb sits beside her, it's actually some of the best shelter we can possibly provide. So that's why there is a great focus on making sure we keep that ewe really happy and healthy, and that will help both in terms of the birth weight of the lamb but also the way she looks after the lamb.
What about the height of the pasture or the feed?
Yeah, so that also can play a role as well. Obviously, the more feed on offer we have, when you think of how small a lamb is, if it sits down in tall grass, then immediately it's quite well sheltered. So that certainly can play a role as well.
And the more feed in that paddock for mum and bub, the more likely she's going to stay put and not wander off.
Yeah, so it's really important that we keep that ewe on her birth site for as long as we can. So ideally for at least 6 hours, but as long as possible, really. And a good ewe who's fit and healthy and finds feed when she needs it right at her feet, so in other words, we've set the paddock up really well, she will stay on that birth site for a long time. And that's what we want for a good maternal bond. Anecdotally, we actually see a bigger increase than what the research has shown in terms of survival, but it will be a number of factors that we get right simultaneously in practical terms. So it's getting the feed right as well as the mob size and all of those things coming together perfectly for us. So I'm amazed at the size of the mobs that we're now dealing with our clients. They're much smaller than we ever expected, and most of that comes about through using temporary electric fencing, which is a very low cost option and quite easily implemented.
Yeah, give me examples. How small?
So we've got a client who will lamb almost 6,000 twins and triplets this year, and their biggest mob will be 160, but most of them actually fall between sort of 70 to 100 ewes in a twin mob. So we've got a number of people this year who will have twin mobs down around 50 across big numbers. So it's a big task to do it, but at the same time, to go and set those electric fences up takes a day or two. We're aiming to try and do it as quickly and cheaply as we can as far as this temporary fencing goes. So there's now a huge number of options available for cheap temporary poly wire. So we use the poly wire, not the poly tape, because it doesn't flap in the wind. Still works quite well. And then we had to find a way to wind them up quickly and easily. So we came up with the idea of using a garden hose reel and cut the handle off it and put a cordless drill on it. And it allows us to wind the fences up incredibly quickly.
That's Nathan Scott from Achieve Ag Solutions speaking to Larissa Smith.
On ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill, this is the South Australian Country Hour.
and it is 12 minutes to 1. Many of the country's best merino breeders gathered in Hay on the weekend for the town's 68th annual sheep show, and South Australian breeders performed strongly, with the Greenfield Stud winning Grand Champion Ram and South Australia's Orikawi Merino Stud claiming the hotly contested Champion Hoggett Ram. Orikawi Stud Principal John Dallard told Angus Verley he didn't expect to win the prestigious title.
Yeah, I was a bit shocked. I knew he was a good ram, and you come into the competition with no expectations to win. You always want to be competitive, and it's always been a dream to win it. But to finally do it was nice change.
Can you describe the ram for me?
So he's a 111 kilo hoggett, just cracking his two teeth within the last week. Got perfect balance, beautiful square back end, good front feet and good heart room, but he's carrying a beautiful soft nourished white fleece and plenty of it, and I think just the extra softness with his great structure got him across the line.
And very strong competition today, wasn't it, with I'd say pretty much every stud here entering into the Hoggett competition?
This would be it's a good start to the showing season here at Hay. It's the biggest prize money going around for a Hoggett ram. So anyone who's got a ram that's any good from Victoria, New South Wales and South Australia turns up to Hay to try and have a crack at the Riverina Hoggett.
And just on that point, what's it going to mean for your business?
Oh, just the extra exposure. We've been showing at Hay for about 10 years now, and just be able to get the opportunity to put him out there, and it was just really, really good to get rewarded for the hard work we've been putting in.
And this award, how does it stack up compared to awards you might have won in the past?
I reckon in my career this is the highlight with showing sheep. Yeah, we've won a few spreams and lots of grand champions, but I reckon one of the toughest prizes to win on the show circuit is the Riverina Hoggett of the Year.
And what will the future be for this ram?
The plan is to retain him in the stud. I was already planning that before we got here. I think he's the top pole ram we've bred this year. I'll take him around to a few other shows and display him and maybe show him later on in the year, but I think he's a ram that we could really use in the stud.
So not for sale?
Oh, everything's for sale.
At a price?
Definitely.
Now, we also had here today the Ian Munro Memorial Blade Shear. You were the judge. You're obviously the reigning Australian champion, a multiple winner. What did you think of the standard of competition today?
Oh, fantastic. It's always a good blade shearing comp at Hay. It's an amateur competition, but every year the quality that the shearers are producing is just improving out of sight. Be the cleanest I've ever seen them shear. I've been judging for the last 4 years now. And, they did a fantastic job.
What is the state of blade shearing? Is it undergoing a resurgence?
It definitely is. And it's not just an Australian resurgence, so worldwide. In Australia, it is a specialty service, basically, for the stud market. All we do is shear young rams for show and sale. And, so it's just a specialty thing, so it's only a short season. But there's lots of people taking it up and wanting to learn the craft.
How many times have you won the national champs?
Be 9 now.
And competing again this year?
I'll have another go in November. But before that, we've got the World Shearing Championships in France next month and start of July. So we'll be heading off in another week or so and going over, see if we can't do well at the World Championships.
What do you think your prospects will be?
Oh, look, you always go into it. You got to go in confident. Haven't had the best lead-up. Broke my hand about 6 weeks ago, so just recovering from that. But they always go in fairly confident, and we've done well in the past. We placed third in the team's event at the last World Championships, so we'll be in good stead to do well again.
And who will your major rivals be?
Oh, definitely the South Africans. They are the best blade shearers in the world. It's what they do all year round. Most of the sheep in South Africa are still blade shorn, and they're definitely the masters at it. Close behind them, New Zealand. They still blade shear a lot of sheep in the highland of New Zealand. The Australians always get fantastic quality points because of doing the stud rams. It's all about the quality and not so much the speed. So we can shear a sheep really neatly. Our biggest struggle is always getting the pace up to try and compete with those guys who do it commercially.
That's John Deller, champion blade shearer and principal at the Orikawi Merino Studs, speaking to Angus Furley. And there were also some Eyre Peninsula studs that headed to the Hay Sheep and Wool Show, including Calandra North Pole Merino Stud owner Sydney Laurie. He says it'll be interesting to see if success at Hay translates to upcoming South Australian sales.
Yeah, it's a good get together. It's the sort of first to the major shows that starts off the March Shorn Young Rams coming through, and yeah, it's a really important one that you get all the medium and strong wool breeders from Victoria, New South Wales, and yeah, quite a contingency goes across from South Australia.
It's a good chance to network while you're there.
Oh yeah, definitely, Brooke. It's really good talking to people from all over Australia and sort of find out where their season's at, and I've got to know some really great people, and yeah, get a lot of good feedback and see what they're doing with their breeding objectives as well, and seeing where their studs are heading, which is really important to, you know, maybe to be able to help us.
Now, I noticed on Facebook and Twitter as well, lots of South Australian studs did quite well. Is it something that SA really impresses when they go over there?
Yeah, Brooke. South Australia did do really well. It was good to see Orikawi for the first time. They won the Riverina Hoggard of the Year, which was, you know, is a massive big honour to win that one. So that was fantastic for them. And yeah, Collinsville were really well. White River were quite good. They had a very good ewe over there as well. It was good. It was really good to see. And then yeah, Greenfield Stud there at Hallett, they got Supreme with a really good ram. So it'll be really interesting to see them go from show to show and see how they improve as the season goes on, and you know, how they progress against other sheep.
And you got a few ribbons as well?
Yeah, I was pretty happy with our results. So we took three rams over, and yeah, we got reserve champion medium wool, and we got reserve champion strong wool in the March Shorn. So yeah, we were really happy with that, so it was good.
What do you think that'll mean when it comes to sale season, which is coming up very soon? How do you think that might translate a win like that, or having those ribbons to be able to display at your sales?
Yeah, look, there's already been a lot of interest in those two rams. There was, you know, interest even before Bendigo. They're, you know, well-proven rams. One of the rams, the medium wool, his grandfather 5 years ago won the same class, and his father came second in the class 3 years ago. So. Or 2 years ago. So it's really showing that, you know, it's breeding quite well, and, you know, that seems to be impressing everyone. So, yeah, it'll be good to see how they go down in Bendigo and what interest we get, and, yeah.
So there's quite a few that head to Bendigo as well, because that's a little bit of a bigger event for sheep producers.
Yeah, definitely. Look, Bendigo would probably be the biggest sheep show in Australia, and, you know, even Western Australia will take sheep all the way down to Bendigo. Quite a few Western Australian breeders bring, you know, pretty much the best to meet there, as well as you have a lot of sheep out of Queensland and New South Wales, and a few studs from even Tasmania. So, yeah, it's sort of where it all comes together, and you've got the strong wools right through to ultra-fines, super-fines as well. So it's really diverse, as well as you've got the British breeds that all come together to compete over that weekend.
What do you think sales will be like this year around South Australia?
Yeah, look, at this stage, you know, the season's just kicking off for some farmers and they're just starting to get a bit of feed. I think if the season can really continue, which is, you know, what's going to start driving it. Prices have been absolutely amazing, and, you know, wool prices have come back a little bit, but still really, really positive. And I think as better wools come on the market, I think the wool market should lift again as well. So just with, you know, quite a few drought-affected probably wools coming onto the market a little bit shorter, talking to some of the brokers saying that is affecting a little bit of the market. So, yeah, I think when some of those better wools come through, the market will lift. And I think it really should translate into better prices, because, you know, return per head's right up there right now. And I think, you know, we'll be right up there competing per hectare with the cropping sector as well.
That's Calandra North Pole Merino Stud owner Sydney Laurie speaking with Brooke Neindorf. Let's head off to the sheep markets now with John Traeger.
Good afternoon. Numbers lifted substantially as agents offered 11,500 lambs and 2,000 sheep, with the regular buying group in attendance and all operating throughout the market. Competition was steady and in erratic sales, prices at times fluctuated wildly on a fair to good quality lamb offering, there being no sense of kilo price difference between crossbred and merino types of similar weights. Extremely light lambs sold firm at prices from $58 to $82, with most going to restockers. Light lambs gained $5 to $10 as they sold from $90 to $152. Light trade weights sold from $125 to $188, gaining $5 to $8. Medium trade weights lifted by from $10 to $15, selling from $140 to $244, as heavy weights lifted by $5 to $10 and sold from $230 to $298. Extreme heavyweights eased by as much as $30 as they sold from $230 to $298 per head. Hoggets were again well represented, with lighter weights selling $10 dearer at rates from $116 to $115. Heavyweights also up $10 and ranging from $168 to $218 per head. A small selection of young Shorn Merino ewes went to restockers at rates from $94 to $128. Mutton of all classes eased $10 a head as light ewe mutton ranged from $88 to $140, with heavyweights making $166 to $204. Light wethers ranged from $122 to $130, with heavyweights selling from $158 to $190. Rams generally sold from $110 to $186, with a single record-breaking sale at $274 per head. This is John Traeger of the South Australian Livestock Exchange for MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service and the Country Hour.
Thanks, John. That's all from me on the Country Hour today. I'll be back with you tomorrow where we'll discuss if farming and agriculture are winners or losers from the state budget, which is, of course, being handed down this afternoon. Until tomorrow, see you later. News time.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.